Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and do a follow-up on the fallout from the Mumbai massacre and the repercussions that will result from this, particularly in Pakistan and Afghanistan as well, and in Iraq and Iran. We'll be speaking with Stephen Cole, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the author of Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden from the Soviet Invasion to September 10th, 2001. He's the president of the New America Foundation Public Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., and his latest book is The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century. And then we'll talk about the politics of transition in Washington, D.C. with Steve Clements, who's a senior fellow and director of the American Strategy Program at the New American Foundation. He's also the force behind the popular blog The Washington Note. And then with the economy yet to hit bottom, we'll look at the engine that drives the economy, which is consumer spending, two-thirds to three-quarters of which underpins the economy. And, of course, people are not going to the mall. And we'll look into the extent of other shoes that might be dropping, particularly with credit card debt, with Dr. Martha Olney, who is a professor of economics at the University of California in Berkeley. And let's now begin with Stephen Cole, who's a writer for The New Yorker and the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Ghost Wars, The Secret History of the CIA, Afghanistan, and Bin Laden from the Soviet Invasion to September the 10th, 2001. He's the president of the New America Foundation, a public policy institute in Washington, D.C. Previously has served for more than 20 years as a reporter, foreign correspondent, and ultimately as managing editor of The Washington Post. He's also the author of On the Grand Trunk Road, The Deal of the Century, and The Taking of Getty Oil. Steve Cole received a 1990 Pulitzer Prize and a 2001 Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award for Outstanding International Print Reporting and the 2000 Overseas Press Club Award for Best Magazine Reporting from Abroad. Ghost Wars, published in 2001, received the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction. And his latest book is The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century. And, of course, Steve Cole, this attack in Mumbai and the repercussions of which are still being felt. But, of course, ubiquitously, the name Bin Laden comes up. I guess, does that irritate you as much as it irritates me that it's a sort of reflex?
Well, it is, although actually in the case of Lashkar-e-Taiba, which is the Pakistan-based group that seems, at least elements of which seem to have been involved in the training and the recruitment of the group that carried out the attack in Mumbai. They do actually have a history with our least favorite criminal fugitive. He was around at the creation of that organization in the late 80s, and more recently up in the Afghan-Pakistan border regions. That seems to be where the hardcore elements of Lashkar have retreated in order to carry on their campaign against India in particular. So in this case, it's not as irrationally reflexive as it often is.
Well, of course, there is a connection when the first high-level al-Qaeda prisoner taken after 9/11 was Abu Zubaydah, and he was captured in a Lashkar safe house in Pakistan. But it seems pretty obvious that with the Pakistan foreign minister visiting India at the time, trying to thaw relations, the possibility that President-elect Obama had a strategy to reduce tensions between India and Pakistan, therefore allowing the Pakistanis to redeploy the army from the Indian border, and particularly from Kashmir, to help out on the western side with the border with Pakistan. All of that, of course, is blown up. And even the Pakistani military itself is now saying, well, you know, we can't possibly move troops now from the Indian border because as a result of the Mumbai attack, India is likely to retaliate. So it's sort of rather self-serving of the Pakistani military, who apparently were pretty recalcitrant about these changes.
Yeah, I think what you said is accurate, and it's actually even a little bit worse than that, because the Pakistan Army at least says, and I don't have any information to contradict this, that they've moved three or four divisions that would, in other eras, be at or near the border with India to the west to fight this counterinsurgency war against the Taliban and al-Qaeda elements and at the behest of the United States. And what they're threatening now is to move those divisions out of the Afghan border region back over to the Indian side in order to defend against prospective Indian military retaliation. You know, we saw this movie before in late 2001 when a Lashkar-linked team tried to enter the Indian parliament in New Delhi, apparently with the intention of decapitating much of the elected leadership of India's parliamentary democracy. They fortunately were stopped outside, but the furor that ensued led India to move its forces up to the border. There was a threat of war. The Indians stood down. In the aftermath of that, the Indians developed a new military doctrine. It's called Cold Start. So the Pakistanis don't have the warning that they used to have, in which India would move its divisions up to the Pakistani border, would give the Pakistanis time to prepare for war. Under the new Indian doctrine, they just can snap their fingers and go from existing deployments. So the Pakistanis are saying, look, we don't know when they'll start. They could start tomorrow, they could start in a month. We need to get our troops out of the west and over to the Indian border. And that would be very bad news, not only for the United States, which counts on the Pakistanis to suppress the Taliban along the border, might also be bad news for the Pakistani government, which is on the receiving end of a lot of these Taliban attacks of increasing intensity.
And back then there was a concern in Washington, I understand, that there could be a nuclear war between these nuclear-armed states, Pakistan and India. Now, of course, we learn from Dawn, which is a English-language newspaper in Pakistan, that the Pakistani government had put its forces on high alert during the Mumbai siege after what apparently was a prank call to the president. That's extraordinary. I mean, it's...
yeah.
This is... we're worried about Pakistan being a failed state or teetering on a failed state, but this is the ultimate of dysfunction, isn't it?
No, it is... You look back at U.S.-Soviet nuclear weapons doctrine and systems for managing nuclear weapons in the late 40s and the early 50s, and right up through the Cuban Missile Crisis, but particularly in the early days, there were people inside the U.S. military establishment who thought that nuclear weapons were just like other weapons and that a nuclear war against the Soviet Union was a good idea and so forth. And you look back at that and you say, oh, that's just so appalling and it's consigned to history and thank God we've evolved. Well, the Indian-Pakistani relationship, especially in nuclear weapons systems, alert systems, deployment systems, doctrine, eyesight on the other's mind, and so forth, it's not much different today than what the U.S.-Soviet equation looked like in the worst period of the late 40s, 50s, up to Cuban Missile Crisis. And the fact that a prank call can trigger an event in the Pakistani system, unfortunately, is not surprising, because although the system is not so immature and so poorly run as to be of a sort of comic book quality, nonetheless, it's untested, it is immature, and there's a lot of the decision makers on both sides are working in a fog about their adversary, and to some extent, on the Pakistani side, there is not a firm consensus between the civilian government and the military about policy or about just essential questions of statecraft. Who is our enemy? What price would we be willing to pay to defend ourselves? That sort of thing.
But Stephen Cole, that the hardware itself, apparently at least the Pakistani arsenal is a pretty reliable one and probably a more reliable one than the Indian one, 60-plus nuclear weapons. So we're not sure about the Indian arsenal, and some of their recent tests were indicated that they hadn't perfected some of the, at least they weren't as mature as the Pakistani arsenal, which of course came from the Chinese. So that's the problem, isn't it? These things, there's enough of them and they would work. And at the end of the day, that seems to be what we're stuck with. It looks as though there's nothing the United States can do or has done to stabilize and improve Pakistan's the state. And it doesn't appear that the Pakistanis themselves want to help themselves. I mean, I may be being unduly pessimistic here, but what's your feeling?
Well, it is the darkest time in Pakistani history since 1971, which is when the country split in half in a violent war that took place in a pre-nuclear period. I've been coming and going from Pakistan for 20 years, and I find now when I return there that many things about the place are familiar and express a form of continuity, but there are changes of a profound character, especially in the west of the country, things you would just have you've never seen in modern Pakistan in terms of the depth and the nature of the insurgency. And, you know, I hesitate to say that it's a kind of a pre-revolutionary environment, but if it's not in a political science textbook sense, it's the precursor stage to a pre-revolutionary environment. And the insurgents control substantial amounts of territory. They have proved impervious to both carrots and sticks. And more worrying than the ebb and flow of the counterinsurgency war is, I think, something that you're referring to even more broadly, which is you look at the Pakistani government, and I'm not sure that they recognize the problem and the threat that they actually face. That's the pre-revolutionary part. I think the state is weak, but it also lacks a certain will about its problems and a capacity to do anything about them, even if it were to find the will. So I worry that this is one of those narratives where by the time the state, that is the civilian establishment and the army, wakes up to the significance of the threat that they face, it will have metastasized too great a degree.
Well, apparently, one of the factors that lead to this blindness is anti-Americanism. It's sort of become a substitute for recognition of the extent to which the Islamists are a threat to the state. And for example, Peshawar, which is right at the on the border there with Afghanistan, where all the supplies, at least those that come by land, and that's the bulk of supplies to NATO and the United States fighting the war in Afghanistan, basically, the Taliban owns Peshawar during the night and the government sort of during the day in a rather tenuous way.
Yes, that's right. And if you travel, as I did earlier this year, out from Peshawar, you don't have to go very far before the Taliban effectively control territory in the day as well. And these are profound changes. I mean, Peshawar is 100 miles from the capital, and the penetration of the capital with these bombings, most visibly at the Marriott and elsewhere, I mean, these are very unusual events, even by Pakistani standards, and they reflect the gathering strength of insurgent networks right within the establishment. There are elements of the army and the intelligence service that are clearly collaborating with elements of the insurgents. Now, I'm not arguing that this is a deep penetration yet. This is not Iran in 1978 yet, but the tide is running in one direction, and as we've been discussing, the state is divided and uncertain about how to respond. And until that changes, I don't think the tide is going to run the other way.
And Stephen Cole, of course, the collective wisdom appears to be that you can't stabilize Afghanistan without fixing Pakistan. And President-elect Obama, to some extent, ran on a platform suggesting that Iraq was a huge distraction, and we should have kept our eye on Afghanistan. And it's not clear exactly what he wants to do about it. But there've been apparently the Bush administration's got a report coming out, more or less saying that unless we fix Pakistan, we can never fix Afghanistan. And Jim Jones, the new national security advisor, apparently came to that conclusion earlier. How do you fix a country that doesn't appear to recognize how much it needs to be fixed itself?
Well, it's not something you can do in 6 months, but there is a pathway, and I think there's a pathway for the best possible U.S. policy anyway, and that's all the United States is capable of presenting. It may not be enough, but it would be an improvement to have a policy that was in fact the most constructive that the United States could come forward with, and I think an approximation of that is on the table with the incoming administration. It's expressed most openly in this legislation that's been pending in Congress called Biden-Lugar, which is a bill that would redirect U.S. policy away from the self-defeating emphasis on military aid alone and affirm through rebalanced investments and other ways that the only way to build a stable, modernizing, and one would hope also democratic Pakistan is to engage with the fullness of Pakistan's problems, not to try to hire out a military to fight a war as the only element of U.S. policy, which I'm afraid has been the case primarily since 9/11. We've spent $10 to $15 billion on direct aid to the Pakistan military, and during that time about $75 million on the Pakistani educational system, just to choose an easy example. There is a robust civil society in Pakistan. There is a secular-leaning middle class. There is a country that does not wish to be ruled by the Taliban, but it's suspicious of the United States, and I think from a Pakistani point of view, for good reason. To them, we look as if our only interest in their country is renting their army to fight our enemies. And we haven't made concessions about trade. We haven't provided aid to human rights activists. We haven't engaged with civil society broadly. We haven't supported their free media. These are sometimes rhetorical statements that we make, but we haven't invested in that part of Pakistan. We've only been investing in the military during the Musharraf regime. In the new elected government, there is an opportunity to try to change that. It's not a perfect government, and this is not something that can be achieved in a short time. But the United States, Pakistan, and India have an interest in doing everything possible to create a stable, modernizing country, because the alternative, its failure with 60 nuclear weapons, is almost too horrible to think through. I think it may be getting to the time where someone's going to have to start thinking about that nightmare, but you would wish to do everything humanly possible to prevent it, because the costs in blood and treasure of a failed Pakistan are almost would probably be the worst state failure in terms of consequences since the Second World War.
And just in closing then, Stephen Cole, there clearly, though, is some sort of duplicity going on here, it seems, because there's lots of questions about the extent to which the ISI, the Pakistani Military Intelligence, had any connections to this latest Mumbai attack. But when we were speaking earlier about how the Pakistan military rather self-servingly said, well, now we can't help you out with the Taliban because now we've got a new crisis with India, it doesn't. There's no proof of complicity, but it leads you to suspect it. And we have reason to have healthy skepticism because of what happened with AQ Khan and what happened with, particularly with Iran, giving them the startup kit for a nuclear weapon. It makes you realize that we've been talking about how the Pakistani government, for what it is, the civilian government, because they oscillate between civilian kleptocracies and military rule. But the long and the short of it is that our side seems to be pretty much in denial. I mean, who's
I mean, as a general matter, you know, in an array of really bad choices, secular civilian kleptocracies are probably a better bet than an Islamist nuclear armed military for us. But I mean, I think you're right. In the big picture, you know, the problem is that the Pakistani state has been using jihadi groups as an instrument of its foreign and military policy for 20 years. And they've never abandoned that essential policy. They have tried to manage it. They have tried to calibrate it more recently under U.S. and international pressure. They may have turned the spigot down to a relative drip, but they haven't dismantled this project or abandoned this approach to their essentially existential struggle with India as they would see it. And until the government of Pakistan recognizes that that policy is a failure, that it will not serve Pakistan's interests, and that it may jeopardize the existence of the Pakistani state or the Pakistani constitution, there's nothing that anybody can easily do. I do think things are changing. I do think there is a kind of discussion inside the Pakistani elite about Frankenstein having come off the table that is different than it was 2 years ago. It's an opening. The government is divided. It's duplicitous in part because it's at war with itself. And so there is an opportunity for the United States to try to shore up those parts of the government that are coming to terms with the failure of 20 years of jihad sponsorship. And that may not be enough, but it's the opportunity that we have.
I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Stephen Cole.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Stephen Cole, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of Ghost Wars, and he's also the president of the New America Foundation. His latest book, The Bin Ladens and the Arabian Family in the American Century. And I'm now joined by Steve Clements, who's a senior fellow and director of the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation. He's also the force behind the popular blog, The Washington Note. And Steve Clements, I was going to ask Steve Cole about his New Yorker article, his recent article, The Test, where he refers to the Obama presidency, quoting, "Great presidencies can arise only from great causes. To define them and deliver on them is the truer test of the office holder." It seems to me that you could almost feel sorry for President-elect Obama. Presumably, you run for president with all kinds of plans and dreams to fix the world and fix America, and it seems like this poor guy is going to be all he's going to be doing is cleaning up the other guy's mess.
Well, the one good thing about Steve Cole's article is it made very clear the connection between great leaders and large crises and. You know, you could have a great leader and not have a crisis, and you'd never know it. You'd never know about the qualities of that person. And so we're going to have an opportunity to see Barack Obama, I think, try to rewire the country, try to create a new domestic social contract inside the United States, and then a global social contract with other nations and stakeholders in the world. And I think that's where we needed to go anyway, regardless of who was president. But I think Obama is showing a lot of the right crafty skills in doing this. And so, you know, I don't feel sorry for him at all in a way because, you know, I feel sorry for the country and we need someone like him at this point.
Well, it seems that from just anecdotally speaking to people about him, he's projecting a tremendous amount of reassurance. I mean, perhaps the bar was really lowered under George W. Bush, but he seems so competent, so on top of things, so engaging. This looks like a presidency that the American people are going to share with their leader, as opposed to the kind of churlish dictates of the decider.
Yeah, I mean, the early signals are really good. He's so smooth and just so cool. I saw a funny cartoon yesterday kind of lampooning his coolness, but to a certain degree, it builds confidence among Americans, and also I think people around the world who are just scared of these times. I mean, we haven't had this kind of pass off of a really horrible national security and economic portfolio simultaneously to another president, and he's just very steady. And when you think about some of the other candidates, let's just say John Edwards or Bill Richardson or even Joe Biden, of whom I'm a big fan of Joe Biden. The steadiness that Obama brings to this and has brought to the entire campaign and then now this buildup has been just a real standout among all of the people who ran for the presidency.
Well, of course, he's not in the White House yet, but it's almost as if...
talking like he is.
Exactly, I'm wondering about, it's certainly noticeable that there's been some backlash from the left-wing blogs and from the political left, I guess. Or is it preemptive disappointment, do you think? I mean, people are already disappointed in some of his appointments, particularly the national security team, before he's even got in the office.
Well, I think yes, there's some disappointment out there. But what I've tried to tell my friends on the left is, you know, I don't know how to put this other than just very directly. Bill Clinton came into office with quite a number of major differences and changes that he wanted to make right on the front end, and he got punished in 2004. In fact, he got punished even before that by people like Sam Nunn and others in the party, particularly on, you know, gays in the military and other issues. And I think what Obama has done is basically taken the Sam Nunn-like characters that exist in this government and put them to work for him, executing what will be his policies. Now, this could all be a grand disaster. I mean, the government could become self-paralyzing. But I think as long as he's attentive and that he doesn't let, you know, crises that will be ahead of us define his presidency as opposed to what he tries to proactively sculpt, then I think we've got a chance to change where we're going. And, you know, I think the disappointment on the left is being remedied somewhat by their support, for instance, of Eric Shinseki getting the Veterans Administration job, a very, very good, solid labor economist, very popular with labor unions. Jared Bernstein has been brought in to be chief economist in Biden's office. Now, while that may sound minor, we haven't seen any sort of labor-tilting economist in the mix yet. And so they're beginning to fill in some of these spaces, and it looks to me that they've been sensitive to some of the marketplace of criticism. It's not going to be enough to satisfy some on the left, but at least he's, you know, trying to bring everyone in, and I think he's not just leaving labor out, which is what I was scared of, and I don't think he's going to leave, you know, the left out when it comes to foreign policy in the far end. And again, I think it's a brilliant move, perhaps, to bring in his chief rival, who was, you know, an advocate of coercive diplomacy and, you know, voted for all the wrong stuff in the Senate on Iran, on Iraq, Hillary Clinton. If he can, you know, make her in charge of laying out the conditions for meeting these world leaders, then I think it's a preemptive move on his part to those who would want to call him appeaser in chief when he's really, in fact, trying to change the strategic roadmap for the United States, which is going to be very tough. But I think he's co-opting all of his potential enemies.
And in terms of labor, what's the likelihood of David Barnier getting a post?
Well, I'm a huge fan of David, and I hope he does. But I got to tell you, I don't know how to handicap these races anymore because there are just too few jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were hearing for some time that one of the other labor favorites, a former CEO, Leo Hendry, was in line, you know, as the alternative to Penny Pritzker to be Department of Commerce, Secretary of Commerce, and he's a guy who he was John Edwards' senior economic advisor, and he brought with him that sort of Edwards package of trying to, you know, redraw the lines of responsibility and benefit among workers, labor, capital, and government, and I think a quite compelling way. And when I saw, you know, whether it was Tim Geithner or Larry Summers or others coming into these economic positions, they just didn't have anybody that thought in those terms. And Hendry has not come in yet. I've been hoping that he might get one of these key jobs. And I'm hoping David Barnier, I mean, USTR is still open. As far as I know, there are rumors about Becerra getting the job, Congressman Becerra. But I don't know yet whether they're going to continue this tilt towards sort of Rubin acolytes or begin to bring in some other economists and economic minds and thinkers that will be more copacetic to where labor wants to go.
Well, Steve Clements, there was an article that was sent to you, which passed on. It was on the Washington Post to all those waiting for the Obama team phone call, which is an amusing look at this environment of expectation there in Washington D.C., where I guess you've had some people sitting around in the wilderness for 8 years, and they're anxiously waiting for the phone to ring. How many? I mean, there's an awful lot of slots, I take it, and this is the way the town works, right? At this time,
well, there are 2,500 political slots that the president gets to appoint. My understanding is that even the first 3 days of them opening up the portals, they had something above 100,000 applicants for those positions. You know, in foreign policy, national security, there are probably 12 really great jobs in the areas you know, you and I and your producer would be interested in. They probably had 400, 500 advisors at a semi-senior level helping him in those areas. So it's going to get winnowed down. And the piece that I wrote, which was written by an anonymous acquaintance of mine, and I put it out under the name Anonymous, was just a hilarious piece talking about what it was like to be wanting a phone call, but you couldn't engage in campaigning for these positions and had to act disinterested. And it would go through all of that anxiety that people felt. I published it on the Washington Note and Huffington Post, and I got something like 800 comments from people all over the world and emails and others just both caught in the, you know, the humor of it, but lots of other people saying, this is me, this is my life, you know, this is what I'm living on. I'm living on the knife's edge, wondering if I'm going to get a call or not.
Well, it's a bit like here in Hollywood, you know, they used to advertise, they still advertise for the Academy Awards, and they send out screeners and stuff and lobby. But in the old days, of course, it was quite overt. You know, they took out full-page ads and, you know, please pick me.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, so all these all the applications go into the transition teams.
That's right.
And the transition team basically is divided up into all the different categories and groups for the various cabinet posts.
Right. Well, I mean, the president and the president's immediate, if say in the national security foreign policy area, you know, the immediate top team has to then begin putting together a consensus of support around their next circle. You know, we sort of know who's going to be the possible deputy national security advisor, the possible deputy Secretary of State.
Well, give us some names then,
some of the names that are the front runners right now for working under Jim Jones. The front runner at the moment is a fellow named Tom Donilon, who used to be a deputy to Warren Christopher. The front runner for State right now is James Steinberg. Now everything could change in a moment's notice, but right now those two seem to have concrete building around them. But, you know, Tom Donilon is less known. Jim Steinberg, who was Bill Clinton's deputy national security advisor, is very well known. But there are other people that want these jobs. And you know, I know both of them, and both of them have been, you know, very fastidiously not campaigning for these positions. But they have support. They're well thought of. They're qualified. But there are a lot of other people that are, until these jobs are locked down and secured and announced, and there's some anticipation in some quarters that, you know, maybe Jim or Tom wouldn't get these jobs and somebody else might slip in. But they're, you know, everyone, then you move down to an assistant secretary or undersecretary and assistant secretary levels. And it's, some people are already getting nervous about whether they should be trying to strut and, you know, publish op-eds and, you know, get on Rachel Maddow's show and things like this so that they can be seen and thought of in these other responsibilities. But, you know, it's a very tense place right now.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Stephen Clemens, the Senior Fellow and Director of the America Strategy Program at the New America Foundation. He's also the force behind the popular blog, The Washington Note. It seems that the appointments that have gotten the most or have created the most disquiet amongst the rank-and-file Democrats who obviously toiled in the vineyards to get this president-elect elected, and he pretty much got elected on what he distinguished himself from his new Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, was that he didn't support the war. So the national security team's getting some real scrutiny, but mostly I think it's holding Bob Gates over that's upset a lot of people.
Well, nobody's really. Gates is complicit in a lot of the decisions that George Bush made.
Right.
And the question is whether or not they've got some sort of understanding that Gates is really going to be part of a change agenda or not.
Right.
And, you know, the honest answer to that is I speculate that Gates has agreed to be, and that Gates can be supportive of trying to engineer a strategic breakthrough with Iran, which I think would be in the vital interest of the country. But we really don't know because Gates, to a certain degree, his role that he played, which was beneficial, was out-Cheneying Cheney and keeping Cheney's team somewhat boxed up during the last few years so that we didn't hatch yet another war in the region. But, you know, we don't know to what degree, you know, the force deployments that we've had in Iraq and the kind of general game plan has been something that Gates designed and was a strong advocate of. or whether this, you know, is something he's now willing to walk away from. But I do think it's a legitimate concerning question from the left about Gates.
Well, I was just going to add, though, that you know, the speculation, as you mentioned, about Gates and Obama having a new approach to Iran. There's also speculation that Hillary would be helpful in terms of bringing about an Israeli-Palestinian settlement, although that's in doubt, particularly if Netanyahu gets elected. But we were just talking a minute ago with Steve Cole about the possibility that Pakistan is already a failed state, and you can't, if we can't fix Pakistan, the Pakistanis don't seem to. They seem to be in denial, the extent to which, you know, perhaps blinded by anti-Americanism. They don't recognize how much, they don't seem to want to fix it or even recognize how tenuous the civilian government is and how powerful the Islamic insurgency is. And you can't fix Afghanistan unless you fix Pakistan. So where's the agenda there?
Well, I think you've answered the question yourself. I mean, either a creative president and his team go in and initiate a grand bargain that recognizes that none of these problems can be siloed off away from the other, and that you need to have really what is a creative and Herculean effort to negotiate new deals throughout the region and deal with the, you know, the interlocking pieces where one problem, say in Israel-Palestine, affects Syria, affects Iran, affects Afghanistan and Pakistan and stabilization deals, that these issues come in, and we have another complexity with the elections in June 2009 in Iran. So you don't want to stumble into something where our missteps or mistakes or something we might do or the Israelis might do could be used by the populace in Iran to sort of, you know, move the more negative parts of the Iranian political spectrum forward. And so there's a lot of that fits in together, and I think, you know, Fareed Zakaria, Steve Cole, others have written about the need for, you know, a really good understanding of a new strategic direction in the region and not to get seduced into overreacting to one crisis or another. And in that environment, you can begin changing the optics and the sort of general morale in some of these countries so that you might be able to get some, you know, positive, mutually reinforcing gains in the region that could affect Pakistan, whether it's a failed state or not, and could affect the climate inside Afghanistan. And it may sound naive what I'm suggesting, but, you know, I don't see many other options for us other than trying to wall off, you know, the whole Middle East, which we can't, and withdraw into American borders. So, you know, I think that right now we're engaged in a convulsive, ongoing hemorrhage that's costing American lives, money. It's convincing our allies we can't achieve our results. It's undermining any kind of global equilibrium or of stability. And so we really need a very different strategic direction that looks at these moving pieces and tries to generate a new equilibrium in the region. And that's why I think we're in a period very much like 1946-47, where we need very smart thinkers to deploy themselves in this region. And I hope that the Hillary Clinton types and her staff and support get with that game and understand that it's very important not to undermine this effort that I think that Obama has convinced Gates and Jones that he wants to do.
Well, just in closing, Steve Clements, I spoke with Winslow Wheeler last week, who's a longtime insider in the Pentagon and on the Senate staff, a very, very knowledgeable guy. And he was concerned that in terms of the defense team that Obama's put together, he thought that they were very much business as usual, because his feeling is that you've really got to talk about have a new strategy there. You just simply we can't continue to build these useless weapons and waste all this money. And, you know, the only way that we've kept these soldiers in the field is by throwing money at recruiting and bonuses and stuff. And unless you bring back the draft, it seems that you know, you've really got to do. It requires some real imagination, and we've got Gates, and I imagine they'll get rid of Edelman and some of the neocons, the vestiges of the last crew. But do you see any possibility of some real revolutionary change over there?
No, Winslow Wheeler is one of the really, you know, bright lights when it comes to trying to think through defense reform. I think Obama has decided to bring in champions of the military-industrial complex like Jim Jones, keep Bob Gates in. Certainly a substantial portion of the Democratic Party has tried to reposition itself as sort of, you know, Pentagon huggers of a sort, you know, wanting a larger military. And I think I've always been a critic of that approach of the sort of Democratic military-leaning establishment. But I think Obama has made the decision that he can't do both. He can't reform the Pentagon, its size, take on the generals on those levels, and get the kind of strategic shifts with other key global stakeholders like China, Russia, Iran, and others. And so I actually do think that Winslow's right, that it's going to be business as usual as far as the way the Pentagon looks and the outrageous amount and outrageous share of the budget it gets. And people may not like that trade-off. The trade-off is going to be what Obama's trying to do is to sort of own the machinery of this complex and the loyalties of these people to force them into a different strategic posture with some of our adversaries and change the game there. And I think that if he were trying to do both of these, he'd fail at both. And that's not a position I'm very comfortable with, because I've always been of the view that we tended to be throwing more and more dollars and more lives into the Pentagon and getting less and less in terms of security deliverables. We don't feel like a safe nation, and we spend just an obscene amount of money on the Pentagon. So Winslow is absolutely right on target on that, but I think that decision has already been made by Obama. And, you know, people should not acquiesce to it if they don't support it, but I don't think that civil society writ large is going to affect that strategic choice that Obama has made.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles today, Steve Clements.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Stephen Clements, Senior Fellow and Director of the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation. He's also the force behind the popular blog, The Washington Note. I'm now speaking with Dr. Martha Olney, who's an adjunct professor of economics at the University of California in Berkeley and is a nationally recognized distinguished teacher. She's the recipient of the Distinguished Teaching Award from UC Berkeley, the Jonathan Hughes Prize for Excellence in Teaching Economic History from the Economic History Association, and the Distinguished Teaching Award from the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, and was recognized in 2007 by the Stavros Center for Free Enterprise and Economic Education of Florida State University as one of the nation's great teachers of economics. Her research interests are in consumer spending and indebtedness. And given the Dr. Olney, that two-thirds to three-quarters of our economy is driven by consumer spending, and we apparently the economy has not yet hit bottom, but already there's some signs that people aren't going to the mall. Is there any imagination out there? We were talking earlier with Steve Clements about reimagining the strategic landscape and out there and making these grand strategic changes. Is there any way that we can get off this credit card consumer drug? If it's two thirds to three quarters of our economy depends upon it, going to the mall, that's not a particularly inspiring example of a great nation, is it?
I don't know that I would disagree with whether or not it's an inspiring example of a great nation. I mean, you figure that we've got a country here with 300 million people in it, and an economy that's based on consumer spending and on spending by businesses for machinery and construction of structures and government spending and whatever net exports we happen to do. And in the United States, we don't actually export more than we import. We import more than we export. And so having two-thirds of our spending from the consumers, from the households, is not unusual. In fact, consumer spending was very stable at about 62% of the total spending in this country from the end of World War II until the mid-1980s. And the concern that I and others have is that what's happened since the mid-1980s was the rise in consumption spending from about 62% of the total up to about 70% of the total. And while 62 to 70 might seem like a not very large increase, it's the sort of increase that has, in fact, sustained the macroeconomy in the United States over the last 25, I'm trying to do my math real fast, how long ago was 1985? 20, 25 years. And that increase in consumption was made possible, or let me say, went hand in hand with a decrease in saving. And now we're going to get back to your credit cards, but also home equity lines of credit, that the increase in consumption spending went hand in hand with a drop in saving. So for the same period, since the end of World War II, as a nation, we tended to save around 8 or 9% of our take-home pay. Now, some of that was some people who were saving for retirement, or they were saving for emergencies, or they were saving for tuition, and other people were borrowing because they were buying a house or putting furniture into it or putting the kids through college. But on average, when you take all 300 million of us together, we were saving around 8, 9% of take-home pay. That share has fallen almost in a straight line drop. I'm sitting here looking at the graph as I talk to you. It's just about a straight line whoosh that goes from about 1983-84 to the present, from about 9% to zero. And so now here we are in 2008, and we as a nation are saving nothing. Now, the only way as a nation that we can save nothing, when you know that there are some people who are saving for retirement, is that there are a lot of us who are borrowing an awful lot of money. And borrowing money in order to spend it, to buy goods and services at the mall or at the grocery store or online or wherever it is that we do our shopping. Credit cards explain part of that, but it's not the big story. The big story is really these home equity lines of credit. The ability of all of us to turn our house, which was always everybody's most illiquid asset, the one that you could get your money out of with the most amount of difficulty, home equity lines of credit have turned a house into an ATM. I have a home equity line of credit, and if I'm a little short and can't quite make the Visa payment that month, I go online to my Bank of America account, and I click here and I click there, and boom, I've transferred money from my home equity line of credit into my checking account. And it's almost, for me, it's almost too easy. And it's the ability to tap into wealth that we never used to be able to tap into, in particular the wealth that we have in our homes, that I think has really fueled that rise in consumption, and therein lies the concern for the future.
But, Dr. Olney, I'm trying to get a kind of a macroeconomic picture here of what you've just described in terms of the broader landscape of the fact that wages have been flat since the end of Jimmy Carter and the beginning of Reagan, and you mentioned it changed in 83. That was the time of under President Reagan. Was there a conscious decision here to change the habits of this country? Because you get the feeling that this is that the only way that we've maintained our standard of living vis-a-vis the rest of the democracies has been through this mechanism. But it's a form of indenture, it seems.
I don't know that there was a conscious decision, but I don't know any research that backs this up, but personally I do believe that everybody takes their cues from what happens at the top. And so when the federal government is spending well beyond its means and not worried about, oh, gee, how are we going to pay for this program, or we've got a tax revenue fall here, what are we going to cut, or any of those sorts of things, that it sets the tone, I think, for everyone else. And so what you see when you look at the data is that all forms of indebtedness rose together. So consumer debt rose at the same time that business indebtedness rose, at the same time that government indebtedness rose. And there, I think, I don't know that it was a policy of, gee, let's set this country on the road to ruin by borrowing excessively and leading everybody down that rosy path. But I do think that the policy of unfunded spending that started at the very top has in some sort of unconscious way influenced everyone else's attitude about whether or not they need to be able to afford what they're purchasing. Now, the concern that I as a macroeconomist and others have is, as we look forward, how long is this recession going to last? And it puts you in a real quandary, because on the one hand, recessions are a terrible thing and people are losing their jobs. And I heard talk this morning about social workers who are being laid off in Contra Costa County or Alameda County here in Northern California. as a result of budget cuts from the state. So we've got state budget cuts that are coming. We've got certainly construction workers who've lost their jobs, and the jobs report on Friday, 500,000 jobs lost throughout the country. So one concern is, how do we slow and eventually turn things around so that this recession isn't so severe? And on the other hand, if the path for turning the economy around to make the recession less severe and bring it to an end is to push consumers back into, borrow, buy, shop, that's what we're seeing now as not a long-term sustainable path. And so it leaves us in a bit of a quandary.
Well, I don't know whether, Dr. Olney, you saw the Frontline special that was done some time back on the history of the credit card. It was quite an interesting piece that Frontline did. And it all started in South Dakota. They managed to change the laws. Apparently, there were laws against usury. You could probably go back to biblical days, you know.
That's right.
So in order to get this credit card boom moving, they had to change the laws, literally change the usury laws. And one of the things that seems to be pretty clear, isn't it, that we've had so much cheap money for so long, for decades now, it's low as 2%. It's pretty clear, isn't it, that the Fed's loaning money at 2% and the banks are turning around and charging 18% and 20 and God knows what else is in the small print. That's certainly smacks of usury, and obviously enormous profits on the part of the bank. So when I was saying earlier, well, maybe somebody thought about this. Well, whether it was a plan or not, certainly it's been to the benefit of the credit card companies, and the banks hasn't known. Up until recently.
My understanding is that the credit card companies actually make most of their profit not off the interest charges so much as they do off of the fees that they charge.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the bread and butter for the credit card companies comes from particularly the fee that you and I don't see, but that the merchant pays. So every time we use a credit card at a store, the merchant is giving over a share of that sale to the credit card company. And the merchant fees and also the late fees are apparently the larger source of income, although it's always a challenge for me to say, gee, if they have all of this income, how do they know that it's those fees that are the part that put them over the top? You know, it's always like the straw that broke the camel's back. Well, how do you know once you've got all the straws in there, which was the last straw? There's a whole bunch of straws there, and the camel's back is broken. So one of their sources of revenue, though, that the credit card companies point to is the merchant fees, and the 18%, somehow this all works out, that the 18% interest rate and finance charges that they're charging us, while it does, of course, pad their revenue, is not so much their bread and butter as is that 2 to 5% charge that they charge for every single transaction. Part of that has to do with the fact that there are many people, about half of the people who use their credit card, pay off their balance every month. And those who carry a balance on their credit cards are not carrying huge balances. And so it's really through the use of the credit card more than the carrying a balance on the credit card. But the credit cards, the concern is not the credit cards, because credit card spending, while people's spending limits are being lowered and while people are trying to pay off their credit card balances, and we've seen a decline in the last month in credit card debt outstanding, That's really nothing compared with the disappearance of home equity lines of credit. In 2007, the withdrawals from home equity lines of credit underwrote about 5% of consumption spending, if you just compare consumption spending and home equity lines of credit. And withdrawals from home equity lines of credit fell to zero in 2008. Mm. And part of that is because banks are tightening up on those home equity lines of credit. People just don't have the equity in their homes anymore with the drop in price. And also choices that individuals are making not to withdraw from their home equity lines of credit. But I'm not prescribing that people go out there and become indebted. But if we don't use our home equity lines of credit, then the consumption spending that we were underwriting with those home equity lines of credit, we won't be able to do because, once again, the saving rate was zero. We weren't withdrawing our savings. We were borrowing in order to do the spending. There's not a path, an obvious path, for the economy to move out of this recession. Now, there's so many things that we used to teach in the 70s that have fallen out of the textbooks that are going to come right back. And one was the paradox of thrift. The paradox of thrift was the idea that what's good for you and I to be thrifty can be bad for the economy as a whole, because it's certainly wise for you and I to not overextend ourselves and not put ourselves into too much debt. That's the smart, wise way to manage our personal finances. But if you and I practice this smart, wise way with our personal finances, what it means is that the economy as a whole is going to take a very long time to recover from the current downturn.
So it's patriotic to go to the mall.
I
thank you so much.
You know what I mean? It's patriotic to go to the mall, but it's not good for you.
Not good for you. I thank you so much for joining us. I'm afraid we've run out of time, Dr. Martha Olney, but thank you for joining us here today in Los Angeles.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just speaking then with Dr. Martha Olney, who is an adjunct professor of economics at the University of California in Berkeley. And we're talking, and she's researches covers consumer spending and consumer indebtedness. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the assistant producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.